you, because Bill had his, yes,
because
Bill had his couple.
Has everybody got one?
Yeah.
Here it is. Ready, boss. We have three pointers. Sounds like you're ready to start. Well, good morning. This is the hardcore group. You want to hear about the how to get it done. And today you're going to actually hear some stories about how it didn't work out. Because that's how we learn, isn't it? Good morning. My name is Bill Lennertz. I'm the director of the National Charette Institute. And we have a really exciting program here this morning about how to avoid post-charette meltdowns. And if any of you have been in this area of work for a while, you probably have experienced some type of project meltdown. And we have three people who are going to talk about successes and failures and keys to making it work after the charrette. I'm privileged to be joined by these three people. Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg, the partner in Dewanee and Plater-Zyberg & Company and dean at the University of Miami School of Architecture, and my former boss and mentor. And last year, Liz said, hey, we need to do a session about how do we make projects work after the charrette. She's very interested in implementation. In fact, in our book, she wrote a piece on the implementation process. So we got together and put this program together, and so Liz is going to share some of the secrets that she's learned over her amazing career. And then we have Steve Coyle, principal in Town Green in Oakland, California, architect, lead professional, one of my oldest friends and a former partner in my firm in Portland when we had it, Leonard's Coyle & Associates, and co-founder of the National Charette Institute. Steve has been practicing in California for many years, where there's some really amazing stories of crash and burn projects. And it's a very hard place to work. I think any of you who are there know it's a very contentious and sophisticated environment. So Steve is going to give us some lessons learned from the West Coast. And then we also have Chuck Bohl, professor at the School of Architecture, University of Miami, and director of the Knight Fellows Program there. And the Knight Fellows, is that the Knight Fellowship Program in community planning? And Chuck is going to be talking about, I think, specifically charrettes that have been conducted by the Knight Fellowship over the years and lessons learned from those. They've been doing them all over the country. So we have three different viewpoints from across the country. And okay, so this is going to run until 12:30. I'm going to do a little piece. Each one of them will do a little piece, and we'll have enough time at the end to talk about questions. And I don't know if you've seen the New Urban News, but on page 2, there was a very applicable story about a meltdown in Pennsylvania. And some of those players are here in the room. We might hear a little bit about what happened in Pennsylvania after a famously successful charrette, where everyone, it was a love-in, and then 2 years later, they put it out for a vote for an ordinance, and I think I got it right. It was declined by a vast margin. So what happened in these situations? Well, let's see if we can figure this out in the next hour and a quarter. So Maureen, could you hit the lights? As we start, I just wanted to let you know that we think that a lot of the secrets are in this book and from the Charette Institute. You can get it out there at the bookstore. But I also wanted to point out that the context of this for us as the Charette Institute is that we're trying to build capacity. The Charette Institute is teaching people how to do charrettes, if you will. We're a not-for-profit. We don't do charrettes. We're teaching and researching best practices in it. And we have a program that a certification program for people in ours, and one of them is run through the University of Miami every year through Chuck's program. And I would just direct you to our website to find out about all of this. Now, what is all of this? And NCI, well, I'll tell you the story. I practiced charrettes with Liz and Andres for many years when I worked for them in the 80s. And then I started my own firm on the West Coast in the 90s with Steve. And in doing so, we realized over time that the charrette alone was not the answer. That you had to have excellent preparation and excellent follow-up. And that's what this session is about. So we've actually coined it as dynamic planning because we wanted to take the attention off the just the charrette for people to think about a holistic project management approach to planning that guarantees success on the back end. So Liz is going to be talking about these three pieces, and they're going to be talking about how things maybe, I think a lot of the answers to success at the end is in this preparation part. And just for your, our curriculum includes many different steps that we've identified necessary to be successful in each one of these three phases. And Liz is going to be talking about a few of these. I just wanted, and we also have extracted 10 principles, and I won't go through every one of them, but it's in the book. What do you need to do at a charrette to make sure it's successful? On the back table, by the way, there's some cards with these in it. And also, if you put your card in this envelope, we'll give you a link to the presentations. So, you guys. Sorry, just pass that around. Excuse me for being so kind of okay. But there are a lot of things that we think need to be in a charrette. I would finally call your attention to a free resource that we've created, which is really having an impact out there. We did some research on requests for proposals that are going out with the word charrette in them. And a lot of them just say, do a charrette. And they don't say what it is. Or they say something else. And so the responses are varied. And in order to get things straight about what you should say a charrette is in a request for proposal, we've created an RFP template, which is free for download. And I also have some copies of it on the back table that you can take away, some actual copies of it. But I just wanted to point out to you one of the paragraphs in it, which refers to this session. It's based on the three-phase process, and in phase three in implementation, these are the different parts of the template to do all these things. But here's one paragraph in F, and I actually got this from Stephanos Palazoides, who said that he includes this in all his contracts now, to include in the RFP that education and training takes place after the charrette. I thought this was really a brilliant move. To conduct training sessions with staff, commissioners, and elected officials to assure that those who are responsible for the day-to-day administration of the plan have a clear understanding of its purpose and process. Some firms put this in their contract, and they won't do it without it. Now, you have to, the more successful places like Hercules, California, has someone there who educates people as they come and go. The electeds, planning commissioners, do this on a regular basis. So, just a note about that template. It's available for free. We hope that it's increasing the quality of public involvement on both sides of the equation, for the providers and for the consumers. And with that, I'm going to just let Liz take it at this point and talk about these three phases and her. Yes. Okay. So, Elizabeth Plater-Zeiber. And you can go to me.
Good morning, everyone. Yes, it's true. I suggested this would be a good session to have, and I initially thought that maybe presenting one case study would be the most effective, but as I began to think about it, I thought perhaps presenting an overview still would be more helpful. And I think, though, as the two others come on, you'll see it gets more and more detailed. I have very simple bullet points that are going to speak about these three phases of work. The first two only insofar as they affect the implementation. So assuming that Bill was in the NCI book really gives you a very thorough picture about the charrette itself. This is really about the aspects of preparation, charretting, and implementation that affect implementation and what I think are the most important perspectives. And I must say it's really hard to just stand up and talk about the failures, so that's why I call this success. So I think these are probably obvious points. It's a kind of reduction of what the charrette book talks to you about, but just to elaborate on it with a little bit of experience. In a sense, these are all equally important, but I think you'll see as I go through the last three slides that the first one is the most important, identifying and engaging the principal implementer. Who's really going to take responsibility for seeing this through? That person must be, and it's a person, must be part of the preparation and indeed lead the process at this point. You can't expect them to come in at the end and, you know, hand something to the mayor and ask him or her to lead it. In the public sector, the mayor is probably the most important leader. Yes, there are other elected people, but the mayors really have the power if they know how to use it. It may be mostly persuasion, but they are in that central position. This is one reason why the Mayor's Institute for Design exists, because that was identified by a group of people a long time ago. But also in the public sector, you might have someone who has taken on that leadership power, such as Larry Beasley, an architect, the city planner for Vancouver, had for many years, or as I understand, the Boston Redevelopment Authority and its leader have had for many years in Boston. In the private sector, the developer, of course, as an individual who will drive a project forward. The corporate structure is very difficult to engage or to give that responsibility to. We have a few projects that will remain unnamed in our office at DPC where you can just see that the various segments of the corporation are all waiting for each other and corporate culture and they don't want to step on each other's toes, and anyway, there's always somebody above you who's going to make the final decision, and that tends to have deleterious effects. Likewise, any project in which the leading person does not see themselves as the implementer in the end, we're going to value the project through rezoning, a plan and a rezoning, and then we're going to try to sell it off, is certainly not a formula for success. So it's really about having a town founder in that role, either in the public or private sector. There are exceptions to this, I might say, which are the charrettes of influence. Our New South Dade charrette after Hurricane Andrew and the Mississippi charrette, I think, are examples of that, in which a collective subconscious is the result. And the kind of improvements that you would hope would happen right away from a specific project begin to happen over time because that opportunity is recognized, even if it's slow in coming. The opportunity of rebuilding is recognized by many who carry those ideas on. So that may be the main exception. Prepare the analysis. Probably the one that can waylay you the worst is a misunderstanding of the environmental context. So not just the documentation that may be required by the authorities, but some kind of understanding and gauge of the whole subconscious or the whole realm of the environmental, not just the activists or the regulations. but playing out the scenarios of how that might work. And this will only be more and more so, I think, as we move forward. We have several projects in which one in North Carolina, for instance, where we even had enabling state legislation to allow us to do a marina along a waterfront, in other words, change the coastline of a river to allow a marina, which was not otherwise allowed. And everybody got out of the way to help make this happen, except one lonely bureaucrat somewhere else in another state agency that held up the project for 2 years. In Aqua, a project some of you know in Miami Beach, although it turned out all right, the lack of a market analysis early on came back to bite us when a market consultant was engaged after the project was designed and added 1,000 square feet to each residential unit. And the whole thing had to be redesigned when it was already fixed to a legal document with the city, which had an FAR, and we had to reduce the number of units. So I think those kinds of things are pretty obvious. And then, of course, identifying everybody who may be involved in the implementation and have them participate in the charrette. And here I think the issue of quality is very important. Who's selected from the consultant, for the consultant group, who in government can be counted on to lead this. They really have to be people of the highest quality. And there's one group that often gets left out because they're often imagined to come in later and carry out a kind of perfunctory role of selling the project, which is the realtors. But in fact, the realtors tell the story later on. And if they don't know the story to tell, which is best told during the charrette, that they can often be working at cross purposes to the project in the first place. Even if it's a downtown project and, you know, somebody's selling that land to developers in the future, they should be part of the story. Of course, doing a good charrette is well documented, but I thought I would just point to several points, again, involved with implementation, which set up the implementation. Design, policy, and management, which you've often heard me say are the three main tools. The design, just like a building, absolutely has to be inspiring and practical. I must say I'm looking at some of the work outside. Now, I didn't hear the explanations for Austin, but I'm not sure that I find big buildings filling in the existing street grid as a very inspiring future for the city we're in. Perhaps the residents find that is good enough, particularly because, just like in my situation in Miami, what has been projected for the city before this was so dismal that this is a great improvement. But I do think having an inspiring plan goes a long way in overcoming some of the slowdowns and bumps along the way, especially with the citizenry in a public plan. And I've often heard in our work in Miami 21, we expected a bigger change. It has to be informed enough to minimize the need for changes during implementation, flexible enough to accommodate adjustments that will occur, and strong enough to survive that kind of evolution. So, for instance, informed enough to minimize the need for change would involve certainly a market analysis so that you know what the full range of possibilities you're dealing with and you don't exclude any that might come back in later and say, okay, this is what we're going to do now, so change the plan because you didn't take it into account. An understanding of costs, relative costs, is it better to have a higher density that takes a longer time to build out, or perhaps fee simple townhouses that might make something happen more quickly and more easily to generate the change. And of course, there are cultural issues. I think probably we've all encountered somewhere or another the neighborhood that does not want the historic image that it's long lived with in deterioration, saying that's not what we want because that represents in some way our limited history. This issue of excellent design is probably easiest in a greenfield site like Seaside or many others that we've worked on where one developer is in control. One anecdote from downtown Kendall, which was is the retrofitting of a suburban site, in which the inspiring piece in a site which really had extreme limitations about changing, for instance, the streets, public works wouldn't participate at all, was the image for the participants, both developers, county, and residents of arcades as not only establishing an image for their part of the region that nobody else really has, but that would in fact make it a comfortable place to walk in a hot climate. Under policy, obviously the charrette has to identify the changes that are required, but also chart the clear path to make those changes. Do you need a zoning code change? Is there a public works problem that one has to deal with? Or is it just a matter of applying design guidelines? Is a new code an overlay or an option? Or is it discarding an old code and starting over? In both downtown Kendall and West Palm Beach, new codes for the areas that we were working on were directly related to charrette production. In downtown Kendall, it was a second charrette, but were directly tied to the plan became law very quickly. Under management, identifying the actions required and who's responsible is particularly important. We often do we've done some of our public charrettes with a matrix in the back that identifies what is design or capital projects, what are the policy changes that need to happen, and what are the management issues. Do you need a crime watch? Do you need to change the way policing has happens? And then who's responsible? So working in the design district in Miami, there were a series of road changes that were required from highway access off the state highway to a county road that needed to be modified to changes of streetscape and city streets. And those are very clearly identified and that who was responsible to do each one. So both the city and the owners of property, the design district retail association, could start lobbying the DOT, for instance, to change that highway access. And that happened within outside the scope of their five-year plan. It happened in about 2 or 3 years. And finally, identifying whether it's policy management or design, the catalytic projects. What are the projects that could happen very quickly to give people the idea that this will succeed? In Providence, Buff Chase's renovation of an old commercial building for lofts, a risky move and early in the action, was very important, as was convincing Johnson and Wales University to stay in town and during the charrette actually designing two projects for them, which they could take directly out of the charrette, a major building renovation, dormitories, and a new entry gate, and they were done. Finally, implementation, which is what all of that has been a build-up to. Once again, the importance of that implementer champion, whether it's the committed developer, the town founder, the mayor, sometimes perhaps the guiding committee, the not-for-profit head. The New York Times had an article recently about Providence in which the role of the mayor and Buff Chase was very clearly described. In West Palm Beach, I think everybody remembers Mayor Nancy Graham, who acted like a developer for the city. Miami 21, a major code change is only going to happen because Mayor Diaz initiated it and is seeing it through. In downtown Kendall, a Chamber of Commerce committee, a kind of committee that meets from time to time just to review things, has not been particularly effective. And the county planner can't run it because he's got so many other things to do. The designers' very strong suggestion during both charrettes that some kind of management entity be established for that retrofit, almost like a CRA, was not initiated or established. I think the fear of losing control, political control, was one reason for that. I've already mentioned the quick result in Providence, for instance. In Stewart, an early town renovation that we worked on, the City Commission came to the final presentation and at the end of it went into session, public session, and voted to approve the plan, a very strong kind of vote of confidence, which is wonderful if you can pull it off. Quality control, this is the area where probably DPZ has the greatest concern with our projects. And the structure that's been set up for a town architect, for instance, for a greenfield project, or public design review, such as in Palm Beach, in which a group of citizens can be, if not the leader, a watchdog. It's a great disappointment if the first projects of a large public process can't be absolutely excellent. And then finally, something that deals with, I think, even the whole issue of governance in cities and metropolitan areas is we've established the charrette as a new kind of public process. Almost any kind of funding legislation or process for urban improvement, including the transportation departments, requires some kind of public process. In our state, I think the DOT makes a kind of laughing stock of it because they figured out a way to provide the process without the result. But it is about how do you engage the public. If there's something that's new about the new urbanism, if nothing else, it's about the fact that the public expects to be engaged in planning processes. And it can't stop at the charrette. What we have to do is figure out, and this I think is our greatest challenge, is how do you keep that process, that public engagement, involved in some ongoing review, assessment, and the making of the intentional adjustments that experience gives you. And so that's a kind of open invitation to consider this, even outside of the new urbanism, about how planning and design become part of the public agenda over the long run, beyond the charrette, and ensure that that kind of quality that a charrette can engage can continue through the long-term implementation of improving places. Thank you very much.
Well, there you have, in a very short period of time, many years of experience and nuggets that you can take with you. Thank you, Liz. I'm going to bring up Steve Coyle, and while I do, I just wanted to mention, I didn't say, you know, NCI has a definition for a charrette, and it has different parts to it. One of them is it's multiple days. So there's more to it than that, but that can be a real differentiator from what people are calling charrettes. Like, I went to a one-day charrette one day and so forth. For us, it honestly has to be at least 4 days, if not more. Okay, I'll give you Steve Coyle. Now we're going to see some projects, some stories that illustrate the principles that Liz is talking about. And that envelope that's going around, if you don't know what it is, it's put it in there. We'll give you a link to the PowerPoints.
Hi, I'm really happy that Liz gave up such a great overview, because I'm going to drill down and show you three case studies at three different results. And the first case study, one and two, are going to be talking about the dynamics of fear versus courage, confidence, and risk tolerance, and how these play out in the charrette process. And the first case study is in Southern California, 7 day charrette, with a national home builder, Charrette Studio. We went all out and to try to provide as rigorous a process as possible. You can see the both sides of the Charrette Studio, opening night workshop, educational exchange, creating the concepts, developing those concepts that were initiated by the public. We started out with about four. We tested them with the jurisdiction, the public. Every night we had pinups where the public comes in and reviews them. They evaluate them in terms of performance criteria. The team reviews the evaluation, and then we now went from four to three concepts, and we pin up the day's work. public comments on those three. We go through another evaluation, refinement of those three. We're now down to two concepts. This is probably around day five of the charrette. The third open house, we're pitting up the fourth day's work. Public reviews those two remaining concepts. And again, we try to do this with rigor. So we're asking people to evaluate as best they can how they're performing in terms of traffic, environmental, and so on. And public finally selects the preferred plan, selects it in terms of their how they're performing and which ones they feel are most meet the objectives that were determined at the beginning of the process. More team stakeholder meetings, drawing up the plan, producing the charrette plan, measuring the plan's performance, and finally presenting the plan at the final day of the charrette. This is really the NCI process here. We actually, in the whole process, not just the charrette, but the entire public process, there was over 1,500 people that participated. So we get to the end of the charrette. There's a typical review process without the charrette, and then there's sort of the NCI approach, which we used here. Now, in California, how many people here are from California? And not many. But I dare say it's not that different from perhaps Florida, Liz, and from New York, and now a growing number of states. There's much more rigorous environmental review process. But we did, in order to sort of inoculate ourselves against the environmental and incident adverse environmental impacts, we had 20 neighborhood meetings, we had community-wide workshops. We went through a process of maintaining continuity from the charrette. This just gives listing some charrette output presentations, hosting neighborhood-level meetings, activating the project website, which had been activated before the charrette, newsletters, community phone line for questions, participation in community-wide events. We had a citrus festival that we helped sponsor, creation of a project advisory group to shepherd the project, composed of citizens, distribution of information at stations throughout San Paul, and we even had a storefront window display where actually people lit up at night so people could see the sort of the process unfolding. So this was the charrette follow-up that hopefully would lead through a specific plan. In California, you on a project of size, you have to go through what's called a specific plan, which is actually fairly detailed. And at the same time, your environmental review is going on. And of course, those of you who've taken projects through, you know there's the technical studies, biological studies, traffic model impacts, urban water management plan, the project EIR, the public hearings. We needed a 404 permit, a 401 permit, a whole processing for what's called a 1603 agreement, developer and schools agreements. All of this are what one has to do once you have the plan generated from the charrette. So this is an arduous process, very expensive and very risky. So what happened here? Well, we went through the studies, we went through Planning Commission review and recommendation to council. We got unanimous council approval. But then there was a small group that filed a referendum against the project. And these were primarily people who were in the hills who objected to objected to density and traffic. But the referendum was defeated by vote, and the project survived. However, an initiative was then filed by the same group, and almost 2.5 years later, the initiative won by a 60-40 vote, and the project was defeated, and the developers conservatively lost at least $15 million. Some estimates are higher. That much in terms of what they've spent on consultants and studies and the whole process. So it was a major, major blow for the developer. And this is the first time they had ever done a T&D or wanted to do a T&D, and the first time they'd ever done a charrette. So this was, and we came out of the charrette with this great glow and then found out that that even the best charrettes can be undermined in the aftermath. So here's some of the lessons learned on case study number one. Long post-Soviet approval times allow oppositions to build and consolidate their power, these groups to build and consolidate power. And these the opposition will weaponize what I call weaponize the conflict points, in this case traffic and density, and spread fear. Fear is their biggest weapon relative to the political value. Now, for projects that are not worthy of the communities, it's probably a good thing they do this, but even good projects or worthy projects are going to be defeated by this tactic or by this strategy. Applied jurisdictional laws and local fear can delay or defeat even the most sophisticated developers. The real, and the equation here is the real depth and breadth of local support equals the capacity and the willingness of the community to fight for the project over time. So that's sort of the equation. You need the depth and breadth of that support over time. And absent deep, pervasive local support, long approval times, jurisdictional laws, and fear leveraged by local groups will undermine even the most rigorous charrette process. And finally, I think the lesson in this particular community is some communities are just too risk averse at this point in time. Now, you know, we're doing a climate change plan for Salinas and some of the outlying communities. The climate change is going to impact communities in ways we haven't, you know, I don't think many people in communities have even anticipated yet. So that may be one of the levers that will get people to move off the dime for compact, mixed, walkable communities. But in places like Southern California, it hasn't happened yet. Okay. Case study number two. This is another California project in Lincoln, which is a community of, I think, about 60,000 people. It's northeast of Sacramento. We did a charrette in 2006. This was a wastewater treatment. This is a redevelopment site, a brownfield site, wastewater treatment facility, about 200 acres. We did the NCI charrette model here. And we do the NCI charrette model because we found it works. Now, we're showing some of the examples that sort of, you know, that had problems, but the model works really, really well if applied properly. Day one, so we went through the same process. We had the community help generate their initial plans. Day two, we review those. This is just giving you an idea of how we evaluate those plans in terms of density and traffic and all the different qualifiers. And then we allow people to evaluate our rendering of their initial concepts. By day three, we're down to two concepts, and then we're down to one concept. And we generate the charrette plan, and then we describe the features of the plan. This is, you know, pretty much the charrette model, the regulating plan, the illustrative plan, the bird's eye view. We also did form-based codes for this, but this is not... we did the coding, a preliminary coding, and then the subsequent coding. So, just to give you an idea of the eyewash, and then here's the schedule. So, the charrette was in August of 2006. The council approved the project conceptually in October 2007, and now we're in April of 2008, and only now are we beginning the specific plan and EIR approval. So, we are hopefully... And recapping this, unanimous council approval, but we have growing neighborhood support, unlike the case study I just showed you, as we begin the specific plan and EIR process. Now, the reason we had this delay is in brownfield sites, we had to go through sort of a more rigorous level of decommissioning of this wastewater treatment facility that delayed the project a little bit, but over 2.5 years later, hopefully, we will gain council approval and EIR certification. So, the plans are going through the same process, but the lessons we learned or learning in Lincoln is if we confront the fears of the stakeholders as early as possible, explain the sort of tough news. Now, in this particular project, the city was redeveloping this site. The city needed to generate about $25 million for the sale of this site. That was the deal breaker. I announced to the public, our first public meeting, that the city, whatever happened, the city needed to generate $25 million so the plan would reflect a value commensurate with that key objective. Now, there was opposition to that, people objected, why $25 million? But, you know, we got that out of the way. They took that up with the mayor or the council. But that... by disclosing that key objective up front, we were able to discuss the how we got to 25, how we raised the value of the land to $25 million as we went through the charrette. So it made it a lot easier to deal with the sort of subsequent issues of density and traffic that and so on that we had to deal with. So we also needed to identify the support and resistance and the difference between these points, the deal points, and stakeholder preference. Those people thought that that should be all apart. Well, it can't be apart because the city needs to generate income from this to build their new wastewater treatment facility. We used performance testing and objective metrics so people could actually, they weren't baited and switched. They felt like they were actually able to see the value objectively. And we secured documented evaluations from the stakeholders. We used decision-making tools, prioritization, preference, and selection so that the public can actually weigh in. It's not just which plan has the most green, but actually they get to go through and sort of evaluate it. And we have continued visible and elected staff support. Post-charrette, excuse me. Okay, let me just stop for a second. Okay, now, 2 minutes. Okay, case study, post-charrette. Last project was one I did with Gary Bellamy of Land Design Studios here in Austin. And this is an example of what happens when you have inadequate funding. This is the North Burnett Gateway Preliminary Concept Plan. Gary invited me down to do a charrette, a 2,300-acre site, redevelopment site north of town. This is basically sprawl, writ large. There's a bunch of conditions which resisted a plan, but we actually did a preliminary concept plan, and I'll just whip through some of the different features of the plan since I only have a minute left now. And but what's really cool about this plan, I just have to say, is we actually have a light rail and a commuter rail, and we have a transit concept plan. So this is really a very cool plan, very connected with a lot of civic uses. But what's happened is the charrette was completed in 2006. There was one section of the plan that was already under development, and the city only now is doing stationary planning almost 2 years later. So the lessons we learned here are, and this is the key, Gary and I did the plan, but we didn't do a code. The city didn't have the money for a code. So absent sufficient political and economic support and commitment, plans will remain underfunded. In other words, the money's not there. So absent adequate funding, only the charrette and the plan can be completed, but no code. Absent the form-based code, the standards for redevelopment, what you really need to redevelop, the plan lacks the regulatory tools for implementation. Excuse me. I guess I just shut myself off. Those are three case studies, three different examples, and I'm done.
Thanks, Keith. Don't start with failure. There we go. Okay. Well, I think this has been a good sequence. I'll reinforce a number of things that some people are saying. We're in the midst of the NITE program in community building. We've done five very large involved charrettes in mostly older downtown areas, older communities with all of the types of urban challenges you could think of. And part of our requirement with the foundation is to go back and evaluate how things have gone. So we're actually in the midst of that right now, but I have personally been back to each of the communities several times. And there is a lot. There's a great deal to learn as you go back to your communities and you see what's happened over time. And they're all so different, as each of these communities is very different. There's different cultures involved, different things happening. I guess I can share. I'll be sharing some of those things I've been thinking about. But part of the struggle in the post-charrette implementation is that
And it's the way our planning and development and design world works. Everything is carried out in such an ad hoc fashion. There are so many hands that touch different places, so many people in charge of different codes and regulations, and on the development side, you know, all other different players. So it's a very, when we talk about implementation, we're talking about a lot of people involved in a lot of activities. And so Liz's point up front about the need for a leader, the implementer, was important. But it, and as, you know, part of the reaction would be, as we are trying to do through form-based coding and other things, is to just control the hell out of it, to code it really tightly, to come up with an alternative manner of regulation and controls to remove the possibility that somebody somewhere is going to screw it up through the implementation process. And it doesn't take much, and it doesn't take any more than a single person to really screw things up. That's one lesson. But the other part of it, that's one approach. That is one valid thing that I think we need to continue to try to do at this point, is to kind of fight fire with fire. But then on the other side of it, you know, we all hop in the plane and we go home at the end of the day. And at the end of the day, it's the local community and the people in the local community that are the implementers. And so I remember Tom DiGiovanni gave a talk about the development of their project in Chico a number of years ago. And he was talking about all the details and going through all these years of the work to develop the project. And he said, you know, at one point I stopped, and this is several years into the project, and I realized I wasn't building a project, I was building a company. I was putting together all of these people with talents to actually implement this idea. And I think the same thing is true kind of coming out of a charrette process. We are ultimately not building a plan or a code or even a project. At the end of the day, I would put it in the larger context of a community, we're trying to build a local culture of good placemaking, of people who will adopt this. So. Here we are at the end of the day. We have our plan. We've learned a lot, in particular from Macon, where our first charrette was back in 2001. We've gone back. We've done full-blown workshops for several days, including some people in this room were involved to evaluate to find out what's happened. After the charrette, all of that communication aspect is so crucial, and communicating in a number of ways. The post-charrette newspapers have been really useful. Lots of people use these and in different forms. You can reach a broad audience to communicate what's happened. In some cases, you really have to know your community. In some cases, you can work just through the mail. In other cases, you have to hand-deliver them to people in neighborhoods. And in other cases, you have to find the places where they can be distributed through community centers and churches and other places, but to reach back to the people. Your full-blown plan, you've got your full-blown plan with all your policy design and management recommendations, and that whole scope of recommendations is really useful because, again, getting at those starting points and those small successes in the beginning to be able to prioritize and say, here are some small things that can be done by a whole range of different players, and they're not all, you know, building a three-story mixed-use building, you know, on day one. There are a lot of little things that can be done. And then other formats. This was one that Dira Tadani kind of turned us on to. It's a little trifold, folds up, and it can be very easily distributed, summarizing kind of major points that it came out of the charrette and the plan. And they're a nice coated paper. They can have a long life. When I went back to Coatesville, which was, I think, 2003 for us, I was back there last year, and I met people in the community, a whole new slate of players. There was a guy who said, oh, yeah, I still have that because I brought some back with me in my bathroom. And I, you know, see it. I look at it all the time. I mean, just the fact that an average citizen would hold on to this document and this vision that hangs around, because most people aren't going to hold on to the big report. Hopefully, you do get to the point where you have an actual code in place to realize the charrette vision and the plan. And in our case, yeah, we did, especially for Macon. Again, this is Dira Tadani following up on the charrette itself. This wasn't done during the charrette, but did a whole set of guidelines. And the plan was actually adopted officially for the neighborhood. So you're all done. And you've got your plan and your code, your documents and everything else, and then you're still not done. Of course, you're really still just beginning. And as Winston Churchill said, if you're going through hell, because everybody's always, oh, we've got all these problems and terrible things happening, you need to keep going. When we went back to Macon, and we had this workshop, this was fascinating, because part of the challenge is the players change over time. So it's really important that there is a vision keeper and that there's some kind of process to bring the new people on board and to renew the vision. And so our first conversation when we did the workshop, I just kind of had an open forum with people, and I asked the specific players, the partners who were supposed to be carrying it out, so what's the vision? What's the vision for the neighborhood? And I got a lot of strange replies. We talked a lot about, well, what do you want to see happen in the neighborhood? And then ultimately I said, well, we're hearing about all these problems. You also need to understand what constitutes failure. And so we came up with a whole range of things that we heard from people that it's not just about building just anything here, but there is a specific vision and that came out of the process that you need to be true to. And there's a path to success, and then there's other paths that constitute failure. And these are not a whole thing to be read here, but I wanted to remember that there was also a whole set of things that related to, and now this is for communities, not for a developer, and there were three partners involved. But we kind of redocumented and went back over, here are steps you need to be taking to actually get things built. So it was a very development-oriented set of recommendations. Then there was another set of recommendations that dealt with, here's how you should be playing nice with each other and remembering what the partnership was about and what the different players were supposed to be responsible for. And it's very difficult when you have not one leader, because the mayor and the city was only one player. You also had a university and you also had a housing authority. You had three players. And this charrette really had it all in terms of the plan, the guidelines. Some money involved, land acquisition, you know, everything was kind of falling into place. And coming out of the charrette, there was a recommendation to create a development corporation to manage the process for the neighborhood. It's a good recommendation. The structure of the board was the three major players. I would say, how can I put it gently, the failure, the problem, where things went astray was in the one person hired to run it. And it wasn't that, you know, that this person was all wrong about everything, maybe 95% of things. But one of the first things he said when he was being hired, they told him, it's partners, we have this charrette process that's going on, we need someone who can convene and manage the process. And he said, well, I can't do that. I can focus on the details of getting things built and everything, but I can't deal with all those people. And that was a major failure. But these were some of the things that came out from the community themselves and people involved. And one of the people involved gave us the first three things. He said, we need to renew the vision, renew the mission, the details about what each of us are doing to get it done, and sell the vision. And then there were other ideas. So what are some other things you can do going in and coming out? Now, the first thing we do going into a charrette is we convene a group that we say, this is the prospective stewardship group in the community. And we convene them before the charrette, and we say, you are the ones who are going to be inheriting the plan that comes out of the charrette. You are going to be the implementers. Therefore, you need to be engaged right from the start, make sure you have the right people in the room, and then you reconvene this group afterward, and you're trying to make a formal handoff to people who will be responsible. This is back in Macon. When you look at all the different possible players involved, this is where things get tricky, you know, and needing leadership out of this group. But it's also getting back to that idea that the creation of a development corporation to run things seemed like a good idea, and you centralized control. But in fact, you had organizations already there that weren't necessarily what you would think of conventionally, like the Housing Authority and a very good historic preservation group, that were doing good work. And in retrospect, and all of this is always in retrospect, would have been much better probably to bet on the agencies or groups that were already doing good work and maybe get them to enhance their mission or extend their mission, give them additional resources to do the work, instead of creating new organizations, new entities, new staff, needing new resources with new agendas. That can get very complicated. And so there's not a right or a wrong. In some cases, like in the Kendall case, where you didn't have essentially a local government to carry things out, that probably would have been the way to go. In the case of Macon, maybe not so much. Also, paying attention to the review process. You know, how does a project get approved? Taking a look at that and seeing, so beyond design, there's all these other ways of getting at implementation. And we did this in Duluth. Liz mentioned for their projects in particular the importance of a town architect, you know, someone there on a day-by-day basis, seeing what's being proposed, working with builders, making sure things get built right. There's a similar need in communities, whether it's an official town architect position or some kind of urban design position or staff that gets trained along these lines who maybe is a planner or someone. So trying to expand that pool of talent of people who can play that role in a community is important. Actual establishment of a design center, a design and development center. This was part of our follow-up on the Mississippi Charette. We've been back and we've done workshops and we've pulled in some directors to talk about the potential for that. I've got 2 minutes, okay? And so you're trying to embed this good design process in the community. Memphis, since we were there a couple of years ago, has created a design center. Some information on that. Good people, a lot of different models for that. The small immediate successes, this is something that the Nashville Civic Center folks did, lighting up the bridge. You know, they didn't have to build something, they didn't have to transform every developer's thought process, but you can do things to have those near-term successes. And then this getting back to this idea of building a culture, a culture of good placemaking. As part of the follow-up to our charrettes, in an urban, really difficult redevelopment situation, these folks just didn't know where to begin. It's an old neighborhood, lots of missing teeth. It wasn't like you could just start from scratch. It was a lot of small-scale infill. And so we took them to meet our friend Dan Camp. In Starksville, we said, look, here's one guy who's done this over a long period of time, so very incremental, small-scale, day in, day out. And had some similarities to Macon as well. So here's the mayor's staff, people from the different partners at Dan Camp's house, learning the way he's done things over time. And then something else that Liz mentioned, the education of leaders, community leaders. The Mayor's Institute has been great with this. One of our fellows, Marie York, took this idea and applied it to Florida, created the Florida Design Institute, extended it beyond mayors to include public officials. Very good, very important. So last slide, a few points, and this is certainly not the checklist, but a few things. The importance to market, communicate, disseminate the plan, the vision very extensively to really reach as many people as possible in as many different forms. The leave-behinds are really important. Vision keepers. For our charrettes, it's always been one of our fellows in one of the communities, and we've kind of rethought this and said, you know, we should really have like 4 or 5 fellows, people that we're training who are in those communities. But it's this whole idea of there need to be people there who it's their vision, and they're the ones keeping an eye on things over time. Who's in charge, the key implementer, and also this important role that it's not just about, enforcing the code, but continuing to be able to convene groups to do that charrette process on a day-by-day basis, that let's get those 3 people in the room, confront what the problem is, and go through it rather than around it and continue to ignore it. And maybe that person's also, plays the role of communicator in charge. Don't reinvent the wheel. Bet on proven people and proven organizations. You shouldn't always be out trying to create entire new entities to implement the plan. Focus resources. Macon was a classic case of trying to do a little thing everywhere, all over the place. Get focused on A Street, A Block. Focus what resources you do have to have your demonstration project or get things started. Celebrate your successes, even minor successes along the way. That's a chance for the group to come back together and say, oh, yeah, we did that charrette, we did that vision, here's a success. It relates back to that. We're making progress. Because most of the chatter is about what's not working. So you really need the little milestones where you come together and say yes and move on. And always getting back to renewing the vision. One of the most discouraging things is when you can go back, as I went back to Coastville, and everybody's changed. All the players have changed. You've had a cleaning of the house in terms of the political landscape. And then, thankfully, the new city manager pulled out our plan and said, I read this last weekend, and I think it's good. So you have to start over. You have to kind of go back, or in a more normal situation, some new players come on over time. Someone, the vision keeper, the convener, the implementer, has to be able to bring that person on board, instill the vision in them, and have them take ownership as well. That's it. Thank you.
Speakers to come back up. And Chuck, I don't know what that beeping is. That wasn't me beeping at you. I'm sorry.
And get us some other questions here. Basically, this was an annexation in a sphere of influence. In California, either you're developing on the ag lands or you're going into the hills. And so when you go into the hills, which is what we were doing in order to preserve the ag land, but it was still within the city sphere of influence, you trip literally every permit and condition you can do. I think that the developer did as much preparation as feasible prior to the charrette. I honestly, if they look back, I don't think they could have done anything better or different, but it was more a case of I think that they lost the ability to maintain public support for the project in the 2 years between the charrette and the actual approval process.
Okay, Liz?
There's an implication in the question that the comp plan is an excellent plan and it should be followed. And
right,
I think in many cases we're faced with a regulatory framework which is not adequate. So you're often contending with that.
Good point.
Yes. What happens when your champion, for some reason or another, leaves the scene? Okay.
This is why it's really important that there's multiple people, hopefully vision keeper type people, who are, they're not necessarily the leaders, but they're watching and trying to make sure that the vision stays alive with the people who are making decisions. And at that point, those people would have to watch who's stepping into that position. Are they a potential person who can take over? You know, do they have knowledge of it, or do they need to be, you know, brought up to speed on what the vision is? And if the replacement is not the right person, they have to find who the right person is to replace them with some similar weight that can be applied to it. So I think there isn't a clear answer, but there has to be somebody keeping an eye on the implementer. And when that person changes, then those other people need to go into action. And
the leader and the backup stewardship group are a very important component. But I think the issue here is that we don't have the governance structures in place to avoid the problem that you're describing. In West Palm Beach, there were two successive mayors who supported the plan for a couple of decades. There was even a referendum right after the first plan to establish a lower height limit than we had been willing to propose. The third mayor that came in is just taking the whole plan apart, and the height limit even is out the window, even though that was a referendum. And I think that's because although there was effective leadership, there wasn't a process for the community to stay involved, and so the neighbors who went to all the neighborhood groups that went to the great effort to support the first mayor had disbanded because they thought everything was going along fine, and they were kind of surprised. You know, they're still struggling with that surprise.
More questions? You, then you.
Narrowing options, you know, coming up in the matter of days, a day for this, a day for that. what if in the pre-Charette time there was a more widespread concerted effort to involve various parts of a jurisdiction that may not be showing up at this one jurisdiction-wide event?
So how can the pre-Charette set you up for success?
I'm going to add a couple of quick comments. We engaged over 1,500 people in a 25,000 person community, which is a pretty good sampling. I mean, had some contact.
Did you do the demographic on that?
What's that?
Do you know who was in the room?
Did she do the demographic?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to overemphasize. Well, the developers spent so much effort in trying to engage people, spent so much sheer money trying to engage people, yet they really, I think, if somebody's trying to swift boat you, okay, and torpedo a project by allegations that are hard to prove. I mean, traffic, you know, is a big one. I mean, it's hard to prove traffic impacts when you have mixed use. I mean, we are in the CNU trying to quantify this stuff, but it's very difficult. So it's relatively easy in this environment, in our regulatory environment, jurisdictional environment, for people to come in after the fact, and the smart people will not allow themselves to be engaged. They'll put on a happy face until after the charrette, at least some of my experiences, and then they'll go in and try to undermine it. They're professionals at it. They know how to do it. Larry Hagman from Dallas fame was funding some of the effort here for this group trying to undermine this one particular project. So, you know, I'm not trying to be a cynic about it, but I'm saying in this particular political climate, it's very difficult. The odds can be against a good development as well as bad development.
If you had known that, would the project have even started?
No. And what's really unfortunate, this was like the third or fourth largest builder in the country doing the first T&D they had ever done and their first charrette. And, you know, the outcome was unfortunate. It wasn't Charette's fault.
So if they'd known that Larry Hagman was against it, they wouldn't have started?
Don't know.
I mean, that's a pre-Charette question. If you've done the research, you have to measure at some point whether you think you can overcome the opposition
right.
or not.
Good point. Although in Southern California, in Northern California, too, there's a great deal of sophistication about, you know, about torpedoing projects.
There are other stories where that's been avoided as well. And I think that we would say that your best defense is in the pre-Charette because it tries to eliminate the unexpected later on. Yeah.
In Mississippi, on the Gulf Coast, we received a lot of planning funds, and we've been very fortunate to have a lot of the folks from the earlier Charette a couple of years ago come back. In Ocean Springs, we just completed that a couple of weeks ago again, which calls for redevelopment of a blighted, mostly minority area in our downtown area. As you were saying, had a lot of missing teams. Can you elaborate a little bit on how you work specifically with the landowners on larger tracts and multiple
owners and how there is no developer in this
case involved? We have planned neighbors like them, but the
implementation
process and working on that new culture
as
you're talking about is a very important and a difficult one. So any more advice on that?
Liz or Chuck?
You know, I would take a look at all of those landowners one by one and identify the person or persons who could be like Buff Chase in Providence, who are willing to take that and maybe less risk-averse or so committed to your community that they would be willing to take the risk to be among the first to step in, and especially if they are not the little guys, but they have some of the bigger properties. I don't know if that's – I don't know your case entirely, but I do know that you're a wonderful leader.
We're about out of time, but before we leave, I wanted to note, if you pick up New Urban News and you look on page 3, I think it is, there's a story about a famous meltdown that's just happened, and it's in Pennsylvania, Lancaster County, where they did a lot of work over years building up support for a project. There was a famous charrette that went really well, and then 2 years later, the ordinance was soundly defeated. And I don't know if, Thomas, you wanted to say anything about that. I mean, it's just a really fresh one. It's in the New Urban News.
No. I'll keep my voice up.
Yeah, just turn
here.
Around.
Or come up here. We'll give you a
chance. I thought it's worth
hearing this fresh off the press.
What can we learn from it?
Yeah, I think that...
Tom's Comita.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Tom Comita. I think the panelists have touched on the main points. I was jotting down sidebar. Long lag time between charrette and vote. No post-charrette training with the municipal officials. At the time when the municipal officials were there, it was a new group, lack of political understanding, and also lack of political will. Lack of connectivity and leadership, a new township manager and planner who weren't there in the charrette. It was a presumed love fest, starting with the county and worked at DPZ, and Bill did in the 90s on livable communities, on through the county comp plan, the regional plan. It was all the stars were in the right alignment. And then one member of the Planning Commission was appointed. It was a neighbor, and we found out later who the Darth Vader was. He started to influence the weaponized group. I did the code. They would not allow me to put the independence plan in to create a true form-based code. They never voted. They just voted to take it off the agenda. And the lesson learned is, who's your Darth Vader?
Who's your Darth Vader?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you can read about that in New Urban News. Thank you, Thomas. And I'll say just finally, one 30-second thing I heard yesterday from Dan Paroli, who's working in Hercules, California, a positive story, where Hercules, mostly one of the reasons is they have some people there like Steve Lawton, who has continued to do educational work with the electeds and the appointed officials as they come in over time. Hercules had a city manager that was going to bring in a big box into their downtown plan that was supposed to be a main street. He actually hired an architect to do his plan, and the citizens themselves started to revolt against that and asked for a hearing on it, and had Parolik or some other people show a plan, and there was the big box plan, and it was soundly defeated. And the community rose up against that and got rid of it many years after that Dover coal plant was done in Hercules. So that was a story of continuing education as people come through. So anyway, we could go on and on about this. It is 12:30. I wanted to thank our three presenters. Oh, yeah, one more thing. NCI has a blog.
Oh, they do.
Get on it. Let's talk about things.
They can ask me questions.
Go to our website. If you have that envelope around, you put your cards in, then I can get you links to the PowerPoint. Thank you. Have a good Congress.
All right, kid. Good job.
Yeah.